were done in a way that cast her in a positive familial light. Is that an inaccurate characterization?
It's not inaccurate, Your Honor, though, although it was undisputed at trial that Miss Carroll is a good mom. Mr. Miller's own witnesses acknowledged that.
Okay. But that still goes to part of what the judge needed to decide. Yeah?
Correct. And there is no evidence in the record at all that Judge Bitney actually ever reviewed Miss Carroll's post.
We'll get to that. But I just wanted to push back on the representation that there was no communication between Ms. Carroll and the judge. So there was, and some of that communication consisted of Ms. Carroll pushing information to the judge with respect to her positive familial light in a case that dealt with the placement in custody of a child. Yes?
There was posts on Facebook as it related to her positive familial life. There was also posts that she shared regarding stopping domestic violence, correct?
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. Without any subjective bias, without any allegation of objective bias, and without any communications regarding the actual merits of the case between the judge and Ms. Carroll, now judges of this state can be disqualified. For the 240...
Counsel, first of all, let me say, I'm standing because I have some back problems today. But when you say there's no assertion of objective bias, quite the contrary. Isn't that what your opposing counsel is asserting here?
They are asserting that there is an appearance of impropriety that goes to so high of a level that they believe that there is bias. But Mr. Miller does not actually allege that he was treated unfairly by Judge Bitney. That is barren from the record, Your Honor.
Yes, but as my understanding of the law that's cited by your opposing counsel is that the appearance of partiality can, on occasion, give rise to objective bias, and they cite several cases for that.
It can give rise to an objective bias. But I don't believe here, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, that there was no communications regarding the case, regarding the merits. Because when you look at the other states that have addressed this issue, and everybody here acknowledges that we don't, in Wisconsin, have an ethics opinion on this, and this is obviously the first case, there was more. There was a communication, the judge posting about the case on Facebook. There was a friend request in which the litigant rejected the friend request and then was awarded a disproportionately higher percentage of the liabilities in the divorce. That didn't occur here. It did not. And that's undisputed. It's undisputed that there were no private messages between Ms. Carroll and Judge Bitney. It's undisputed that any of the comments on the post by Judge Bitney, 12 were related to Bible verses. Couple were related to his knee surgery. One was related to the American flag. In the cases that have addressed this, the South Dakota Supreme Court in Onan versus Sioux Falls Independent School District addressed that, in which a judge received a Facebook message wishing him happy birthday. That wasn't constituted to be improper. And when you look at the Supreme Court rule, it says judges may not initiate, permit, engage in, or consider ex parte communications concerning a pending or impending action or proceeding. It contemplates that judges are people too. You are going to see litigants, attorneys, witnesses at coffee shops, at restaurants.
This is a fact-intensive inquiry, it seems to me. And the Court of Appeals relied on a couple of factual, they focused on a couple of the facts. Paragraph 2, the summary of their opinion, indicates that they gave great weight to the fact that the circuit court communication or connection was undisclosed and that it was with a current litigant. Could you focus on why those two factual matters are of no import?
Sure. It's a 25-day friendship, Facebook friendship, that we're talking about. It occurred after the close of the evidentiary hearing, but before Judge Bitney issued his written decision, although he made clear in the record that he had already rendered his decision. He just hadn't put pen to paper. I think that when you look at the timing of it, it's inconsequential. We're still talking about an innocuous Facebook friendship in which there were no communications regarding the actual merits of the case. Certainly, a judge should not permit a litigant, an attorney, a witness, a party, whoever it may be, to send private messages. Certainly.
Counsel, is it true that during that 25-day friendship period, she contacted or sent messages in his direction 21 times?
I don't believe there was 21 messages. There was.
How many do you think there were?
Well, there were no private messages. There was 18 likes on different posts, and there was two comments wishing him well on his knee surgery, which at the close of evidence he had informed all of us.
So there were 20 posts during that 25 days, not 21. Were any of his or the exchanges between them disclosed during the course of the hearing?
Well, they occurred after the evidentiary hearing, Your Honor. They weren't, and then after.
But did the judge, before he made his ruling that was issued to the parties, did he disclose them prior to that ruling?
No, he did not.
Can I?
Can
I push back a little on the 25-day window that you've narrowed? I understand that that's the most concerning part because the message, because she sent him a friend request during that time period that he actively accepted, and that was the one active thing that he did. Well, first, do you agree to that? That's the one thing. People walk into coffee shops, but he actually actively, I know how Facebook works, he had to confirm that request, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so that's the one thing. But why 25 days? Because the case still went on. I know the challenge was then made, but he then went ahead to be, there was a motion for consideration, reconsideration. To the litigants, probably was just as important as the initial ruling. So the friendship, he never, I don't know when, if she actually got off of Facebook at some point. It's the record, I guess, is unclear on that. So why 25 days?
So the record, if you look at 107, Exhibit B.
Okay.
And Mr. Miller, in his brief, makes issue of this last post. But after the decision was rendered, Ms. Carroll left Facebook. She said, quote, I'll be bouncing off Facebook to focus all my attention on Bruce and helping him through these tough changes. His brothers are so excited to have him so close. After the decision was rendered, she went off Facebook, so correct.
Okay, all right. That wasn't clear to me from the record. Okay, and will you also address that last? Here's what I see the issues. I see a couple things that are disturbing to me. One is the active confirmation of the request that the judge made. So this isn't like they were already friends, and or he walked into a coffee shop, or she sent him a letter, and he didn't open it. He actively did something. That's the first thing. And the second thing is really to me that potentially. That post, even though he's made his decision, he still keeps the case. So she's now talking about the case.
I think when you look at the post in totality versus just the snippet that was put in the brief, it's a loving, caring mother who is getting off of social media to focus her time on her child. And the timing of it as it relates to this argument that you're having to be able to blast posts at a judge or make communications with the judge, it's not here in this case.
We don't know if he read the post. Do we know if he was tagged in that post?
He was not tagged in this post as best as I can tell.
Is unclear.
And he made clear during the hearing on Mr. Miller's motion to disqualify a reconsideration that we had accurately summarized the substance of the Facebook communications, which were the 18 likes, the two comments, which he did not respond to, and that there was no other communications or views.
So you don't see a problem with having seen this last post, even though she then gets off Facebook, he now continues to have the motion for reconsideration, and he's seen this last post where she's going to be this painting herself to be this loving, dedicated mother and thanking him profusely in that respect.
I think that the law of this state is that we trust judges to hold the balance nice, clear, and true under all the circumstances, and that would include Facebook. I don't think that a post saying, I'm going to focus my attention on my son, should now persuade judges one way or the other. And I think that the Florida Supreme Court, which, although not binding, is obviously persuasive, I think the decision of law offices of Hussein, which Mr. Miller does not address in his brief, has some very well-rationed decision-making here as it relates to Facebook. And they say, if traditional friendship, without more, does not reasonably convey or permit others to convey the impression that they are in a special position to influence the judge, then surely Facebook friendship, which exists on an even broader spectrum than traditional friendship.
But this was a new friendship. This was a friendship that didn't start until this matter of custody was proceeding, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so we're not looking at, I thought the Florida case was very good in that it talked a lot about what goes on Facebook, and I thought it was quite a helpful reference. But we're looking at something that began when there was a matter pending before the judge. And if she had made the comments that she made on Facebook in a letter, she certainly would have had to have sent a copy to you or Mr. Miller, as well as commenting to the judge, correct?
Well, the comments didn't involve the actual impending case.
You have to listen to my question. If these same comments were in a letter rather than on Facebook, certainly wouldn't you agree that she would have had to have sent a copy to you, Mr. Miller, as well as commenting to the judge?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You think ex parte communication with the court is okay then, right?
Matter's
pending?
I don't believe ex parte communications are okay, but when you look at the case, the actual rule, it says concerning a pending or impending case.
And you don't think posting anything about domestic violence concerns the case when that was part of the judge's ruling in this case, as I understood it?
It was part of his ruling, domestic violence. The two separate Barron County judges had found domestic violence in this case, but I don't think that it's credible to say that Judge Bitney's opinion regarding domestic violence changed based on a post saying we should stop domestic violence. I think everybody believes that we should stop domestic violence.
What if your client had sent an article about domestic violence to the judge? Do you think that it would have been okay for him to read that and not tell the other side that your client had sent him an article?
Well, I think in hindsight, which is 2020, I wish that there was no Facebook friendship, because I think on the substance of this case, we prevailed and we should continue to prevail. But I don't think that an article that's not dealing with the actual pending or impending action, facts specific to that case, facts specific
well,
to...
Well, when you're dealing with family court matters, people's lives matter. People post on Facebook all kinds of personal things. They post photographs of their children, photographs of them with their children. All of that information is pertinent to many family court matters, isn't it?
Correct.
So I think, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to create a rule coming from this court that would allow litigants to, I think the amicus brief framed it this way, to weaponize social media so that litigants could force recusal upon a judge. But isn't the issue here the judge's acceptance of the friend request with respect to whether he should have recused?
I think that's part of the issue. I don't think that it's the totality of the issues, because I think you have to go a step further. I think you have to look and make sure that there's actually more before you issue.
But the problem here is we don't know what more there is, because we really don't know exactly what Judge Bitney may have been exposed to when he accepted the friend request of your client.
I think, Your Honor, we do know that Judge Bitney has 2,000-plus friends. To say that he would have had time or to review each of Ms. Carroll's posts regarding domestic violence or not, I concur with Your Honor that that's not in the record, that he actually viewed them or did not. I know that what is in the record is that the posts that Ms. Carroll liked of Judge Bitney's were unrelated to the case.
Does it, should we take into account how it looks to the other side, how it might make the other side feel that they discover after they received an adverse decision that the judge accepted a friend request from the other side for whom he ruled?
I think as part of the objective test, you look at a reasonable person standard. And I think when we look at the different ethics opinions that have been issued, specifically the American Bar Association one, a reasonable person could not believe that in this instance, with 2,000-plus friends and with no communication specific to this case, that Judge Bitney was somehow persuaded to rule in Ms. Carroll's favor.
One more question for you. I sat in children's court in Milwaukee County, and frequently the judges there, and I'm sure it's the case across the state, would receive communications from family members who probably didn't know that it was not appropriate to send a packet of letters and photographs and information about the children and the family to try to sway the judge's opinion, but they would do it. We would receive those with frequency. And the regular course under those circumstances is A, the judge doesn't look at it, B, the judge discloses it on the record, and then asks the parties if they wish to look at it, and then the judge, or if they want the judge to look at it, and then it's shared with everybody so that everybody has an opportunity to weigh in or respond to what was presented. Do you think that that is what should have happened, even though the evidence had closed? Do you think it would have been a better practice for the judge here to say, I received this friend request, I've accepted it, it has no bearing on my decision, but to make the other side aware of it?
I think that it goes to that question of the presumption that we give judges to hold the balance nice, clear, and true. I think that a better practice perhaps would have been to say, I received this, it has not impacted my decision at all, because none of the communications are related to the facts of this case, to the merits of this case. But when there is no argument that Judge Bitney was actually biased, just the appearance of bias, I don't think that's enough to get Mr. Miller over the hump here.
So the case law that I saw and that was cited to us really involved attorneys. And I think it's a different question when we're talking about being friends with attorneys on Facebook. This was a litigant. I didn't see any cases involving Facebook friendships and judges of litigants in cases currently pending before the court. Were you able to find any?
There was the, yes, there is. There is the Chase versus Loisel, L-O-I-S-E-L, Florida Court of Appeals decision, in which a party refused the Facebook friend request from the judge and thereafter asserted that she was attributed most of the marital debt and her former spouse received a disproportionately excessive alimony award.
That was a party refused it, right?
Correct.
We got nothing. I'm looking at judge and litigant. Judge and litigant before judge. Anything like that?
It was judge and litigant.
Okay. So was it a
yes.
Judge that refused a Facebook?
It was the litigant that refused the Facebook request.
Of the judge.
Correct.
Okay.
And then afterwards made an allegation that the judge had, quote, retaliated against petitioner after she did not accept the friend request.
Okay, and I think I did see that one, but that's a little bit different. I don't know. Nothing similar to what we have, right? And there's
Correct.
Certainly nothing in Wisconsin.
Correct. There's although the Hussein case, the Law Office of Hussein case, does make reference to it does not believe that a friendship between a judge and a litigant, a judge and attorney, a judge and a witness, without more, does not overcome the presumption. But the facts of that case were not a judge and a litigant.
Okay.
Counsel, I wanted to just talk a little bit about, you know, the test here, talking about the law. Would you agree that there is a difference between an allegation of a constitutional due process violation and a violation of ethics opinions or ethics rules or even statutes?
Yes.
So a number of your, I guess, responses to my colleagues' questions have been defending the propriety of what occurred here. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to address the possibility that what the trial court did in this situation was not what he should have done and could have even constituted a violation of ethics rules, but nonetheless not rise to the level of a due process constitutional violation.
I agree, Your Honor, because I think when you look at the Martindale versus Rip case, this court's 2001 decision, for an error to affect the substantial rights of a party, there must be a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the outcome of the action or proceeding. Here, there's just the allegation of an appearance of partiality, but not actual partiality. And I think that's why in our brief we said, first of all, we don't believe that this gets over the hump on the presumption that judges are fair and partial. But even if it does, we believe that it's harmless error, because he's not, Mr. Miller does not allege that because of this Facebook friendship, Judge Bitney decided in Ms. Carroll's favor.
Well, I mean, if something is a constitutional violation, the Constitution provides a right to an impartial tribunal, correct?
Yes.
Right. So if we meet that standard, I can't fathom how we could possibly have harmless error. What we could have is a situation where what he did may have been inappropriate and may have been wrong, but nonetheless does not rise to the level of a constitutional problem. The constitutional standard, as has been described, is actual bias or great or substantial risk of actual bias. In other words, it seems like the law here is that it's either at the line of you are definitely not biased or, like, come on, of course, right? I mean, it's been generally pretty extreme circumstances when you've seen this arise. It strikes me that the Court of Appeals opinion here would be potentially a pretty expansive or a pretty large expansion of due process jurisprudence when it comes to actual bias.
I agree. And because when you look at the cases in which the United States Supreme Court has recognized an appearance of bias necessitating recusal, it's in which there was an actual, the judge had a pecuniary interest in the case. That's not here. So I agree with Your Honor that that would be a broadening of that rule. And I don't believe that this is the case on these facts.
And it doesn't actually matter, does it, what ABA judicial ethics opinions might be or any of those sorts of things. Even the U.S. Supreme Court in Caperton and other places has made can and maybe even should provide much more stringent standards than the Constitution provides, right?
Correct. I don't think when you, I don't believe that this court is obviously bound by the ABA ethics standards, but I think they're very helpful. And I think the amicus made a good point of let's not broaden this unnecessarily. Let's have a committee appointed to investigate the judicial use of Facebook and social media, because Facebook is at issue in this case, but there's a number of different platforms of social media. And the Court of Appeals decision here, when there was no subjective bias, and I see that my time is up.
Yeah, you can finish your comment, Justice Hagedorn.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. When there was no subjective bias and when there is no allegation of actual objective bias, just the appearance, I think adopting the Court of Appeals rationale is dangerous precedent for judges of the state and litigants and parties of the state. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and you'll have time in rebuttal then.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Terry Moore. I'm with the Herrick and Hart Law Firm of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and we represent Timothy Miller. As the Court has realized, this is a case that has some very specific facts to it. And the Court of Appeals decision was very clear that its decision was based upon those facts. And those facts involve a judge accepting the friendship request. Now, I understand the argument of, well, a friendship request really doesn't mean a whole lot, but yet it does. There is a reason why Carroll made a friendship request. She was seeking to somehow earn favor with the judge while he was making his decision. This was not a friendship that had been established years before. It was not a friendship that existed out in the community. Instead, it was one that was established while the case was pending.
But to my earlier point I was making with your opposing counsel, we can't allow litigants to weaponize social media in order to force judicial recusal, can we?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And that's why what should have happened, I think everybody realizes what should have happened, was when that Facebook request came in, Judge Bidney should have denied the request, should have informed the parties that the request had come, and then admonished them not to do it again.
Isn't social media, particularly social media like Facebook, just another way for judges to be involved in the community? And so when I'm looking at cases involving, well, it's not that new anymore, is it? But newer technologies that come long after we have some established legal principles. What if instead of a Facebook request, what if the judge and Ms. Carroll were members of the same Rotary Club, or they attended the same church, or they frequented the same bar? These types of connections, I think, are more common, especially in smaller communities like this. So if that happened, if they ran into each other at church or at the Rotary meeting pending his decision, do you think that should have been something to be disclosed?
Well, I think in that situation, you need to look at what was the contact. And I would agree, in a small community, up in Eau Claire even, which Eau Claire's not that small, but I run into the judges quite often, or litigants will run into the judges. The judges have to make sure that they do not cross that line. And so that they need to make sure that they don't go into becoming or making it look like they're being influenced and that their decision could be affected by that contact. I would point out that, and if you look at the Court of Appeals decision, part of really what the Court of Appeals was looking at, it wasn't the fact that there was just one contact. It was a series of contacts. It was a series of contacts during the time that the decision was pending, and it was undisclosed. It was a culmination of everything. And so if the judge were to run into the litigant at church and they said, you know, hello, how you doing? Now, depending on what that initial relationship was, there may have been an initial requirement that the judge disclose that relationship to the other side, i.e., I go to church with this person, I don't have any contact with her or him, I don't believe that that will have any effect on my decision, so that the litigants know it.
If this communication that occurred via Facebook had been disclosed before the judge issued his decision, would we be here right now?
We potentially could have. I think part of it depends when it's disclosed and what is given the opportunity to either rebut it or to address that issue so that if there is some type of a substantial error, that it could be corrected.
Are you asking us to implement a blanket rule regarding judicial use of social media, or are you looking for a very narrow decision that applies specifically to these facts? And if the latter, tell us what those facts are that make this case different than judicial use of social media in other contexts where they might have a Facebook friendship or a Twitter follower, if you will, from a litigant.
Sure. We are not asking for any sort of bright line rule that says judges cannot be on Facebook. I don't believe that that would be beneficial to our judicial system. The same as judges should be out in the community, they should be on Facebook and have a Facebook presence. What I do believe is that this case needs to be tailored based upon the specific facts, the same as what the Court of Appeals was looking at. And those facts, you know, we start with the fact that there was this hotly contested two-day hearing on June 7th and 8th involving custody issues. So that one of the things that's about that is that the fact finder, Judge Bidney, is going to have to determine who he believes, who's the credible witness. We then go from there that the briefs are filed on Friday, the 16th, and on Monday, the 19th, Carroll makes the friend request to the judge. And the judge affirmatively accepts it, which I think is an important aspect here. A lot of social, or some of social media, as I understand it, Somebody can do something, and it doesn't require the other party to do anything. Here, the judge specifically did something. He specifically accepted that friend request. What is missing in the facts is why he did that. He certainly did not indicate that there was some sort of an error, that he was mistaken, he didn't know who she was, anything like that. We're left with the conclusion that he wanted to be her friend.
Well, judges have to be elected in the state of Wisconsin, and so some judges just might accept every single friend request because they're looking to make connections with anybody who might vote for him or her down the line. So it is possible, isn't it, that the judge accepted the friend request somewhat blindly without even paying attention to from whom the request came.
And if that was the case, I would have expected Judge Bitney to have told us that. He was quite open about saying, yes, those were all the contacts that I had with her, that those posts that I made and she accepted. So if he had done that in this blind fashion, then I would have expected him to tell us that.
One last question for you, and then I'll let my other colleagues jump in, because I think, I'm sure they do want to. With respect to the Twitter example that was given in the amicus brief, I thought it was a good example because there people can include a judge's Twitter handle in a post. And, for example, somebody who's got a case that might be coming up to the Supreme Court could insert one of our or all of our Twitter handles and have very case-specific information in there. Do you think we should implement a blanket rule that under those circumstances, if the judge sees it, he must disclose that communication?
I think that the disclosure part would be appropriate, because you have now seen something that somebody has put out there with regards to that case. Just the fact that it was disclosed does not mean that you have to recuse yourself, though. And I think that's kind of where what we're looking at here. I mean, it's the same as most. I think there are other cases because of publicity that the court hears of. I mean, you read the newspaper, and just because you hear information doesn't mean that you are now biased and unable to decide or sit on hearing
our
case.
Rules basically contemplate that we give the benefit of the doubt to the judge, and in fact we kind of leave it up to the judge to say, I was influenced by this, so I'm going to recuse, or yeah, I saw this information, I'm letting you know about it, but it has no bearing on my decision, right? We do allow judges to make that call.
We do. And in the problem we have here is, as was pointed out by the Court of Appeals decision, when we have the timing of this and the content and the fact that it was never disclosed leads to this appearance that there is a partiality that this judge now has, and that partiality has gone and tainted the proceedings to the point that, unfortunately, Mr. Miller is no longer getting a fair trial.
Counsel, I'd like to address the question of remedy. I see that the United States Supreme Court in the Lilleberg case addressed that. And there it said, it is therefore appropriate to vacate the judgment unless it can be said that a respondent did not make a timely request for relief or that it would otherwise be unfair to deprive the prevailing party of its judgment. What did the Supreme Court mean by it being otherwise unfair to deprive the prevailing party of its judgment?
Well, I think in the situation whereby that party maybe had nothing to do with what has caused the error. And in this situation, that is not the case at all. The error arose because Carol specifically made the request to become a friend to the judge.
All right. So let me just take this in small steps.
Sure.
So would you agree then that it is possible that a court could say, you know, that does present a question about the judge's impartiality. Nonetheless, we will allow the judgment to stand because it would be unfair to deprive the prevailing party of its judgment. Is that a proper thing that a court could do?
If it's determined that the error was not a structural or constitutional error, then yes, I think the court could do that, basically using a harmless error standard.
So the United States Supreme Court was dealing with a question of a necessity of recusal for a failure of impartiality, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Is that always a structural error?
Yes, I believe that if the judge's partiality has been called into question and there is evidence under the objective standard or a subjective standard, for that matter, if it is a constitutional or a structural error, then prejudice is per se, and it would need to be sent back to be retried in front of a unbiased, impartial judge.
So why did the Supreme Court say that, notwithstanding the impartiality problem, that the judgment could stand if it was unfair to deprive the prevailing party of its judgment? That suggests that this does not always require a vacation of the judgment.
Well, I think that there could be a fact scenario under which...
Let's stick with the law first.
Okay.
So so you said that if it is, if there's a failure of impartiality, that that is a structural error and necessarily requires vacation of the judgment.
I would, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But the Supreme Court seems to suggest that's not the case. Am I reading Lilleberg wrong?
No, because I believe what the Supreme Court is saying is that there may be a facts situation. That
hang on. Before we get to the facts, we got to get the law clear, right? So if we're saying that a failure of impartiality is a structural error that always requires vacation of the judgment, right, then it would not be possible for the United States Supreme Court to say, given that structural error that always requires a vacation of the judgment, nonetheless, you don't have to vacate the judgment if it would be unfair to the prevailing party. Deal with that part first before we get to the facts.
I believe that the Supreme Court is setting up a situation where, based upon the facts of that case, that there is an opportunity for the court to continue or to keep the judgment in place.
Okay, so structural error does not always require vacation then?
No, because they could find a situation in which they would not have to vacate it.
Counsel, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I wanted to just make sure I properly understood the ex parte communication argument. I didn't read you as saying that there was a separate actual ex parte communication going on, and I want to make sure I was reading your argument correctly. But the facts of this case opened up the possibility for ex parte communication, which you saw as contributing to the overall due process problem. Was I reading your argument correctly?
That is correct. Okay. Under a strict definition of ex parte communication, the communications that Carol was making by liking the Facebook posts was not directly an ex parte communication. She wasn't specifically saying, Judge, here's something about my case. But I do believe that she was trying to influence with those communications, whereby she was liking a Facebook post such as one of the prayers that the judge had posted. By doing that, she's subtly indicating to the judge, Judge, we're of like mind. I too am religious. I too can be somebody that you would trust, that would be the good mother, that would be the appropriate party to have custody of these kids. And so while it's not an overt ex parte communication, it's certainly a communication that is just between her and the judge. It doesn't involve Miller or the GAL. And it's conveying a point that she wants to make to the judge, that he can believe her, that he can trust her, that he can find her credible.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals, however, did find that there was ex parte communication, as I recall. They set forth several factual and legal reasons for their determination. And in paragraph 24, they deal with the ex parte communication, ending paragraph 24 as follows. Further, as explained below, ex parte communication occurred to the extent Judge Bitney and Carroll viewed each other's Facebook posts. And then they continue defining what an ex parte communication is. So in that regard, do you depart from the Court of Appeals?
No, I do not depart from the Court of Appeals in that regard, because I believe that the Court of Appeals was looking at it from a standpoint, again, you have a communication between one of the litigants and the judge that is not disclosed to the other party, so that's ex parte, and the Court of Appeals was looking at it saying, you know, these posts that were about domestic violence, that's an issue in this case. I believe, too, that they were looking at it as the posts of Carol liking the judge's post as being a communication back to the judge about her character, about her being a good parent, being somebody who's trustworthy and credible. And so I believe that that's the standpoint that they were looking at it in. Again, in a very narrow context, I don't think that they were trying to say that every, you know, time you might say hello to the judge, that that's an ex parte communication. But in the context of this case, because of the issues that were involved, then they could be very well be ex parte communications.
Is there, when getting to your last point, there very well could be, is there an issue when it comes to Facebook, at least, that we don't know if he saw the post? We know he's active on Facebook. He's posting a lot. In those 25 days, we got 20 posts. I don't post that much. But we don't have any idea what he saw. So is that a complicating factor here? A normal ex parte communication, you know that it was received. So we don't know, even if she's trying to communicate with him, we just don't know if he's received it.
Well, Your Honor, I would actually indicate a comment that he made later on that indicates he did see them. And that was when, on the motion for reconsideration, and the issue was brought up, and it was brought forth by Carol as to, and, you know, here are the posts that I liked, and here was my post. And the judge said, yep, that's what occurred. The only way he can say, yes, that's what occurred, is if he had seen them, and if he had...
So he never denied seeing the posts?
That is correct. He did not deny seeing the posts. His only comment was, I did not like any of her posts. But he did not deny seeing any of the posts or seeing the notifications that he would have received that she was liking his posts.
Counsel, what should we do with the judge's assertion that he'd made his decision on how to rule in the case before he accepted the friend request?
Well, Your Honor, I have a little bit of a problem with that statement by the judge from a standpoint of the brief and the GAL report were filed on Friday, June 16th. The friend request was on Monday, the 19th. Now, I would expect Judge Bitney to have reviewed those briefs, to have reviewed the GAL report. There's no indication that he did that in the 2 days and made his decision between the time that those things were filed and the date that he accepted that friend request.
I would expect that he would review the briefs as well before making the decision. That would be my assumption. He did say that he had made his decision, however, prior to accepting the friend request, which suggests to me that he did read the briefs prior to that.
And maybe he had kind of generally come to a conclusion based upon the testimony. But we still have the fact that he's having communications, he's accepting this friend request. As I indicated before, he only accepts it if he wants to be her friend, if he wants her to somehow be in his circle.
Okay. Yeah. So let's say it can be proven to a metaphysical certainty that he reviewed the GAL briefs, made his decision prior to accepting the friend request. Does that affect the analysis?
I do not believe it does, Your Honor. And the reason I believe that it would not affect the analysis is because in this situation where we're dealing with the appearance of partiality, his decision doesn't get rendered for another 25 days. During that period, certainly Carol doesn't know that the decision has been made. She's trying to do everything she can to influence him to rule in her favor. And then her last post basically says, the judge gave me everything I wanted. So to that extent, there certainly is this appearance because the decision was very favorable to Carol. It went from a joint placement, it went from a joint custody to basically Carol had sole custody and placement was greatly limited. So to the extent that it was a decision that was very favorable to Carol, and you have leading up to that decision, this interaction whereby she keeps liking his posts because he's now agreed to be a friend of hers. Certainly an appearance that he is no longer an impartial judge in this matter.
Counsel, but just to get back to this legal standard here, the question isn't whether there's an appearance of bias. That's not what the due process clause has been understood to require. It's whether, I'm not saying there's no inkling of an appearance there, but traditionally, at least more recently in the due process clause, U.S. Supreme Court has stated it's actual bias or substantial risk that we're basically right up next to the line, that this is egregious and rare. In Caperton, it went out of its way to say, listen, there's all kinds of stuff that's going to come up, it's going to raise issues. But normally, appearance of bias stuff isn't a constitutional problem. Those are very different things. It has to be sort of extraordinary. Caperton was a 5-4 case. Williams v. Pennsylvania, you had the prosecutor who prosecuted a case, and it was even a vigorously contested case whether that rose to the level of due process. So can you make the case that this is the sort of extreme situation where the risk is so high, so disproportionate, that we couldn't countenance it?
I believe it is, Your Honor. The appearance of impartiality or the appearance of partiality, the loss of impartiality, is such a fundamental right to what a litigant gets to expect when they go into the courtroom that and a standard that has been set by this court is that what a reasonable person would conclude based upon the conduct at issue. And in this situation, a reasonable person would conclude when you have, while the case is going on, while the decision is pending with that judge, one of the litigants requests to become his friend. He accepts that. She then proceeds to like 18 of his posts. And none of this is disclosed. When you put all of those things together, along with the decision that is greatly in favor of Carol and against Miller, a reasonable person would conclude that there is this, that the impartiality has been shattered, and now the proceedings are tainted to the point that the only thing we can do is go back and do it again in front of a judge who is impartial.
Well, there's a couple of Court of Appeals cases that talk in some vaguer language that way, but I'm unaware of this court ever holding, as a matter of fact, or the United States Supreme Court ever holding that mere appearance is enough. That mere appearance, it would certainly be enough to trigger some statutory recusal issues, and it would certainly be enough to trigger our ethics rules. And there are questions there, but your claim is not a statutory or Supreme Court ethics rule issue. Your claim is that the Constitution, as a matter of due process, which traditionally understood in its original public meaning, had always been understood to prohibit an actually impartial tribunal, that is actually what's violated here.
Well, I do believe that when there is the appearance of bias, the appearance of partiality, that has struck the chord that there is actually the fundamental right to have a impartial judge try your case has been violated. And as such, then, there is a structural error.
Do you see a difference between what the statutes require and our ethics rules and what the Constitution requires? And if so, could you flesh that out, please?
With regards to the issue before this court, I believe that they are the same. That is, our ethics rules, the statutes, all require that a litigant receive a trial in front of an impartial judge. And that is what the Constitution requires. So all of them line up the same to say that if you lose this fundamental right because the judge is biased, if the judge, it can no longer be impartial, then it is a structural error.
Chief Justice Roberts, admittedly, this was in his dissent, but he wrote, you know, many state statutes require, and this is in Caperton, require recusal based on probability or appearance of bias, but that alone would not be a sufficient basis for imposing a constitutional requirement under the Due Process Clause. States are, of course, free to adopt broader recusal rules than the Constitution requires, and every state has, but these developments are not continuously incorporated into the Due Process Clause. Do you disagree with that proposition?
I do not disagree, other than I would start with that is in the dissent, and so that is not the majority opinion from that case.
Counselor, there is a standard that comes out of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's actual bias or the great risk of actual bias or substantial risk, I think, is the term they use. When you try to evaluate that second part of their test, does it matter the context in which the challenge arises? For example, here we have a custody dispute, and you're looking at the personal characteristics of the mom and the dad. We could have the same kind of challenge when you had a foreclosure on a house, and there was a friend request between the person foreclosing and the mortgagee. Or you could have it in, if you had it in a criminal trial, that would be also a different context. So does the context in which the challenge arises make a difference on whether we should say there's a substantial risk of actual bias?
I do believe that the context would have some effect on it. The same as I think all of what happens would have a substantial effect on it. Going back to the situation where if the Facebook friend request or if they had been friends for a number of years before the trial comes up, not an active friendship by any means, then it comes into play. That would be one scenario. That's not our scenario. And I think when you look at all the specific facts of our scenario, that's where it really starts to, that this structural error has occurred, and it is of a significance that requires basically a do-over to restart so that the litigants can be assured that they are having their trial before an unbiased judge, that the community can be assured that a judge has not been influenced because you can friend him and then like his posts, and he'll keep it secret from everybody, and then lo and behold, you get a decision that's in your favor. Whether it was influencing or not, there's certainly that appearance.
Counsel, the risk of bias under the case Gudgeon, paragraph 26, speaks of from whose perspective. The perspective, it says, is from that of a reasonable person, not whether the trial court thinks it is there is a risk of bias or an appellate court thinks there's a risk of bias, but rather it's viewed from what the reasonable person here, I suppose, the reasonable person litigant. How does that language comport with Caperton?
I do believe that when we're looking at this objective test, and the objective test is where it comes in as to the reasonable person, what would they conclude based upon the facts? And I think that is actually a good standard for us all, because the same as we can't read the judge's mind. I can't go and read Judge Bitney's mind to find out, was he biased or was he not? He can sit there and say he's not biased. I think every judge would say that they're not biased. And that's a good thing. I mean, we don't want judges that are biased. But when you pull it back and you look at it and say, well, wait a minute, when you add all of these things up, when you look at all of these factors, all these facts and things that happened, what would a reasonable person say based upon that? And that's why I think we use that objective standard so that we can have a look at it. We're not trying to read the judge's mind. We can look at it and say, well, wait a minute. if for no other reason, because this is such a fundamental, basic premise of our legal system, that a person can be assured that they will have an unbiased and impartial judge hearing their case, that they're allowed to make that decision or to look at that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As you begin, counsel, I want you to address whether the context in which a communication through social media, such as occurred here, makes a difference. So does it matter that this was a custody dispute? Would it matter if this were a criminal case before the court and the defendant were communicating or the prosecuting attorney for the state were communicating with the judge? So the context interests me.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do believe that the context would matter. I think it's not only the context of the case, but more importantly, the context of the communications themselves.
Well, I'm looking at the context of the case. Thank
sure.
You.
Because when you're talking about what is the presumption that we have here for judges, I don't believe that when you have, in any case, we're presuming in any and every case that all judges of this state are presumed to act fairly and impartially. And when I don't believe that when you say there's 18 posts that are unrelated to the actual facts of the case, that that should get over the presumption. And whether it be the context of a family law case, whether it be the context of a civil case, there needs to be more. There should be communications between the judge and the litigant, or the judge and the attorney, or the judge and the witness about the actual merits of this case to get over that presumption. And that's not here. That's not here.
Counsel, if Mr. Miller does get over that hump, is the remedy vacating the judgment?
I don't believe so, Justice Kelly, and I believe both you and Justice Hagedorn were hitting this point on the constitutional issue. The mere appearance, which is all that has been alleged here, is not enough to make the claim unconstitutional. We have that as both in the Lilleberg case. This court, also in State v. Carpoor in 2004, said the same thing. There's got to be more. The mere appearance is not enough. A lot has been made about whether this should have or should have not been disclosed. When you look at ABA Opinion 488, it says, quote, "A judge therefore has no obligation to disclose his or her acquaintance with a lawyer or party to other judges or parties in a proceeding. A judge may, of course, disclose the acquaintanceship if the judge so chooses, but need not to." And when we look here, all 2,000 of Judge Bitney's friends, including Mr. Miller's sister, would have been able to see the likes on Judge Bitney's post by Ms. Carroll. That is not the type of private communication that erodes confidences in our judiciary. That's not the type of communication or situation which overcomes the presumption that all judges have, that we can ignore any of those outside influences or biases and make a fair decision on the merits, which is what Judge Bitney did here. And he did disclose it as it related to the motion for reconsideration. He disclosed that the friendship request was made. He accepted it. He disclosed that those 18 likes and two comments were it. That was all. It's not the type of situation in which there was a number of private emails or messages or letters or communications regarding the actual merits of the case occurred here, because it didn't, and that's undisputed. I believe that there has to be more here, and I believe that this case presents the court with a couple of different paths. One, it could adopt the Court of Appeals rationale, which would further brighten the line, I believe, that judges of this state are prohibited from the use of social media. I think that's bad law. I think it relegates judges of this state to the life of a hermit. And as best as I could tell, the majority of this court is on Facebook or LinkedIn or some sort of social media. And I believe that all of you made that decision knowing that even being on social media, you could make fair decisions based on the merits in the law. I think, second, the court could reverse the Court of Appeals and say that this situation, this Facebook friendship, is not enough to overcome the presumption. Or I think third, the court can say, shame on Judge Bitney, he shouldn't have accepted the friend request, but it's not enough. this was not a constitutional violation of Mr. Miller. He does not allege that he was treated unfairly. That is not enough to make a constitutional argument. With that, I thank the judges for their time and would respectfully request that the Court of Appeals order be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for bringing us a really, really interesting case, though I've never felt like I'm not on Facebook. I think it has to do with my age and your age. It may have something to do with our differences of perspective. But it's a really, really interesting case, and you both did an excellent job for us. It is a matter of first impression. We're going to take a break now so that the next case can... Thank you very much.